You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When she was at the Harvard Business School, Deborah Spar was one of the few women on its faculty and one of the youngest professors to be tenured. Now she's the president of Barnard College, an institution where the gender balance is very much the opposite. She was raised in what's been called a post-feminist era and grew up believing that she could have it all, family, husband, and a high-powered career. But trying to balance the often conflicting demands of those roles taught her the limits of social change and made her recognize the struggles women continue to face. Her new book, Wonder Women, Sex, Power, and the Quest for Perfection, is published by Farrah, Straus & Giroux, and I'm pleased that it brings Deborah L. Spar to our show today. Hello.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be here.
Was there a specific moment when you realized that you actually had achieved pretty much everything that you dreamed of?
Well, there was this one very awkward moment that I use as the first story in the book, and it's really not a pretty picture, but it's when I was in the ladies' restroom at LaGuardia Airport en route to a business trip 3 weeks after my second son had been born. And I was pumping breast milk in the stall at LaGuardia Airport, which is really sort of a horrible thing to be doing. And it was one of those little light bulb moments where I said, wow, this is what I wanted, and it's really not nearly as glamorous as I thought it would be.
So you felt kind of deceived that you'd been led to feel that having it all could be easy and natural?
You know, I think it was a combination of deceived and foolish because, you know, when I look back and I talk about this in the book, it was never really that anyone showed up and said, guess what, Deb, you can do whatever you want. It's that somehow I was reading all of these messages and picking up everything that was in the ether. So it was me who kind of interpreted or misinterpreted it in this way.
Well, do you think that women who grew up when you did in the 70s and 80s thought of themselves differently from their predecessors who'd lived through the feminist movement only a decade earlier?
Yeah, I think we did. And I think, it's interesting to note how narrow the generations are, because women who are only 10 years older than I am had a very different experience because they were teenagers or young women fighting for reproductive rights, fighting for admission into the Ivy League. You know, by the time I came into my late adolescence, Roe v. Wade had been passed. The Ivy League, with the exception of Columbia, was fully open to women. So I think girls of my generation understandably didn't really feel like we had to struggle because others had done that for us.
Are you surprised that reproductive rights are again a major issue?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of shocking the extent to which they're back on the agenda.
So did you take many of the breakthroughs they'd made for granted?
I did, and I think it wasn't just me. When you grow up with something around you, it just becomes the norm. It's like kids today don't think of iPods as technology. It's just their life.
Well, in the earlier generation, people like Andrea Dworkin presented men as kind of like the enemy. Had we gone past that?
I think, you know, just speaking personally, you know, I don't think I've ever seen men as the enemy. And I think one of the very good things about the moment we're in right now is I think in general, women don't see men as the enemy. And I think men, certainly all the men I've known who run organizations, are really trying to do whatever they can to get more women into positions of power. They're just having a tough time.
Your generation wasn't about burning bras, although I think one woman once did it. But instead, they were having charge accounts at Victoria's Secrets.
Well, it turns out I've come to learn that in fact, the bras were not burnt at the Miss American pageant, as urban legend had it. But yeah, I think women my age and younger, you know, we didn't grow up with that struggle. And so we really seized the advantages as something that was sexy and exciting and fun.
So did you feel you had two identities, both as a sexual person and as someone who could accomplish a lot?
Yeah, and I think many women do. And if you go back, as I do in the book, and you look at just the media images, the print media that we're surrounded by, look at television. Look at television heroines. They're running law firms, they're running hospitals, and they're gorgeous and sexy.
And when did that begin for you? In high school? In college?
Yeah. I mean, I describe in the book this commercial that foolishly perhaps had a very strong impression on me, and it was the Charlie Perfume commercial, which started airing in 1973 when I was 10. And it was a very seductive commercial. It was Shelley Hack was the model for most of the commercials. And she was clearly going off to work in a pantsuit and with a briefcase. But she was sexy and attractive. And there were men in the background and children in the background. And I think, you know, that was the life that many women of my generation just sort of assumed we'd be leading once we became adults.
You say that early in your career, after you were already married and had a child, you assiduously avoided any contact with feminists?
Yeah, and that's something, you know, I've come to regret later in life. But I think that was a moment where women like myself were making it in the workplace. We were starting to climb the ladder. And I guess I felt scared in some way that, you know, I didn't want to be ghettoized or marginalized. I wanted to be not quite one of the boys, but I didn't want to be seen as someone who was going to constantly be sort of harping on the women's issue.
Well, did you believe that you were being treated as an equal with the men in your department?
You know, it's a mixed bag. I think in many respects, my career took off because I'm female, because I really was of that generation where, you know, the Harvard Graduate School wanted women among their students. Harvard Business School desperately wanted women faculty. I think I was really at an advantage because I was female. But it was only later in my life that I started to realize that being female also carried disadvantages, that I was treated differently, not out of anyone being evil, but just, you know, it was more awkward for men to take me along on business trips and things like that.
Well, do you think it's because you were in business? Because my experience, and I'm of an earlier generation, was that all the people who got the best marks in high school were the girls. And I think that if some of them didn't do as well in college, it had more to do with the fact that they then felt that they had to make themselves more attractive. And that sometimes meant not being as smart as they really were.
Well, this is where the statistics really get depressing. Girls are across the board doing better than boys in high school. They're more than 50% of the college population. They're more than 50% of most graduate school populations. And yet, when you start looking at higher and higher levels of any organization, it's not just the business world, it's the nonprofit world, it's the arts world even, women fall out. So that you see this same stubborn statistic that at the very top of any organization or any sector, women are only 15 to 20% of those seats of power. And that's across all sectors.
My guest is Deborah L. Spar, her book, Wonder Women, Sex, Power, and the Quest for Perfection. So you started to accumulate small resentments over what kinds of issues?
Well, and they weren't even so much resentments as just sort of observations, you know, the jokes about, you know, you could end class by jumping out of a cake, or you're getting high scores from the students because they like your legs. I mean, that's the little stuff.
Who was saying that to you? Your colleagues?
My colleagues, you know, with a smile.
And they thought it was funny?
They thought it was funny, and, you know, it wasn't the end of the world. But the much scarier thing for me was noticing as I got older that most of my friends from college, who were every bit as smart and ambitious as I was, had dropped out of the workplace. That most of the other women faculty members I started with at Harvard Business School had not gotten tenure and had turned to other places. And that even the women I was teaching at Harvard Business School, super smart, super ambitious, were not having the kind of careers that their male colleagues were.
Judging from a front page story in the New York Times earlier this month on September 7th, Harvard Business School is still struggling with that issue. How were you asked to address it?
Well, and let me just say, I love Harvard Business School. I was there nearly 20 years. I learned a ton. And I think it's to their credit that the school is really struggling to try to fix these deep-seated problems. Years ago, I was one of the people called in to sort of help fix the women's problem. And we did some of it. We put a maternity policy in place. When I first started, there was no maternity policy at the school. They really tried to put in parental leaves, family care leaves, but the underlying culture still remains pretty male.
Well, the Times reported that year after year, women who had arrived at Harvard Business School, can I say HBS?
Yes.
With the same test scores and grades as men fell behind.
Yeah.
Was it because they were treated differently in the classroom?
You know, it's hard to get a sense of this unless you've actually sat in that classroom, but it is a pressure cooker. There's 92 people in a room without windows in a grading system where 50% of your grade is what you say in class. So it's very, very aggressive. And I think it's not just women who are at a disadvantage. It's students from other cultures. If you're coming from a country where you never challenge the professor, you're going to have a tough time at HBS. And I think for many, many years, women were at such a distinct minority in the classroom, it made it even harder for them to put their hands up and argue. And if you don't put your hands up and argue, your grade is going to be lower.
Well, when I went to school, the boy who commandeered the class discussion always was the one we hated the most. Right. So
well,
I guess it's different at business school.
Well, but you get rewarded for that at HPS.
The article in the Times said that the administrators installed stenographers in the classroom to guard against bias grading and provided private coaching for untenured female professors. Some students felt like they were back in kindergarten being taught how to raise their hand and to listen politely.
You know, it sounds absurd when you read it, but having lived through it, I actually don't think it's absurd at all. One of the things I would watch in the classroom is I would see a woman who I know was having a hard time, as we say, getting in, and I'd watch her put her hand up and then pull her hand down and then put it up tentatively and pull it down, and I couldn't call on her, and her grade was going to suffer as a result of that.
When you were there, were you aware of a secret society known as Section X?
No, I wasn't.
But that was a society that was all male?
You know, to be perfectly honest, I don't know anything about that. Or I don't know more than I read in the Times piece.
So would you describe Harvard when you were there as a hostile environment for women? Was Larry Summers at Harvard when you were there?
He was, and I wouldn't describe it as a hostile environment. You know, it's a tough place, as you would expect, but I never felt the subject of any hostility.
Well, what did you think at the time of the controversy he stirred up when he talked about the differences between men and women?
You know, Larry Summers is a complicated guy. He's a lightning rod of a guy. And I think there was already a lot of antagonism towards him at the university.
And there still is.
And, you know, he's a guy who draws criticism. So I think, you know, what he said in the context turned out to be unfortunate.
Well, he suggested that biology plays a role in the differences.
Yeah, and I think that was something that Larry Summers, in the position he was in, couldn't say. But I actually do say that in the book, because I think, you know, it's a tough thing to say. But I think it's something that should be put out there. You know, men and women are different biologically. That doesn't mean that women are inferior. But I think if we deny the biological differences, we actually make it harder for women in many ways.
Were the issues that you came up against the same issues that feminism has sought to eradicate, or did they take another form?
Well, I think, you know, feminism really has been remarkably successful in terms of giving women like me opportunities that my mother and grandmother didn't have. I think what we're facing now is sort of the next wave of more subtle obstacles. They're not the guys in the corner office being jerks anymore. It's just the fact, I think, that particularly once women have children, and because women biologically do have the children, their lives evolve differently than men's.
Well, Clarence Thomas, who was a recipient of affirmative action. It helped him move up the ladder. Now says that affirmative action is something that is used against black people. Mm-hmm. And also it hurts their own sense of self-esteem because they feel perhaps they didn't earn that spot.
Right. And I think there's different sets of issues. But I think for women, the corollary is, and this is the phrase I hate most in the world I live in, is when people come up to me and say, you know, we really need a woman, or, you know, you're very talented, you're just right for this job, and we need a woman. That's patronizing. And I think, you know, we have to make sure we don't move towards a system where women feel like the only way to get ahead is because they're female.
Well, Christine Quinn, many of her defenders said that she partly was hurt by the fact that she was a woman. And I thought, well, gee, she ran the city council. There were a lot of men who wanted that job as well. So it is a little more complicated.
It is more complicated. And I think, and there were some nice articles about this, women running for office, women in the spotlight, still get kinds of questions and levels of attention that men don't get. You know, it's very rare that a male political candidate has his wardrobe become the subject of contention. Yet for women, it happens all the time. We're seeing it around Janet Yellen right now, with the possibility of her becoming Fed chair. You know, people talk about her looks, people talk about her wardrobe, people talk about her family in a way that they don't talk about when it's a man.
And many people have written about Hillary Clinton's hairstyle.
Constantly.
They did write about Bill Clinton's haircuts.
That's right, but not as much.
Deborah L. Spar's book is Wonder Women, Sex, Power, and the Quest for Perfection. It's published by Farrah Straus and Drew and the Sarah Crichton imprint. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. We're back with Deborah L. Sparr, president of Barnard College. She's written a book called Wonder Women, Sex, Power, and the Quest for Perfection. It is published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. So you've worked in a male-dominated institution and now in a female-dominated one. Are they fundamentally different as a result?
You know, they're not fundamentally different. They're not fundamentally different. But I keep joking that when I moved from Harvard to Barnard, I underwent some kind of massive hormonal shift, because working at a place that's run by women really is different than working in a place run by men. And I don't think one is better or worse than the other, but they really are different.
Can you tell us about how each institution went about changing its website?
Yeah, so this is one of the little examples I use in the book. When Harvard did its website many, many years ago, you know, there was a group that did it, and it sort of was a top-down decision, and it played out, and the rest of us sort of just signed on and, you know, logged on as we were told to do. You know, at Barnard, when we began this process, it was, I think, more inclusive from the beginning, but became increasingly inclusive as we went through it, because everybody wanted to jump in, everybody wanted to be involved. And, you know, the good news is that it was a much more consensual process, that we did get everyone's opinion. You know, the bad news was that it was longer and, you know, harder in some ways, because, you know, it's difficult to make something that everybody in the organization is going to like.
So you left Harvard Business School to become the president of Barnard College. Was anyone surprised?
Yeah, I think lots of people were surprised. I mean, it was a very big shift to make. It was moving from a male-dominated place to a female one, from a business school to a liberal arts college. But it's just been a fascinating transition for me. And, you know, I love being in a small college setting.
You call it a small college? I mean, Barnard and Columbia are an immense university.
Barnard still feels, you know, it's your classic liberal arts college. We have a little bit under 600 students in every class. And so it's small enough that you recognize people, you know faces, you know everyone on the faculty. So even though it's you know, deeply connected to the much bigger Columbia, it still has a pretty small college feel.
Lisa Belkin wrote in the New York Times about women in successful careers who opted out to raise their children. And there was a very strong reaction to that article.
It was outrage, if I remember correctly.
Why do you think that women respond to the conflict between parenthood and work by pulling back?
Well, first of all, not all of them do. And I think that's one of the reasons the article did engender this almost violent reaction. But I think there's a problem we see right now, that because women have this myth that they can do it all, that they can be fabulous mothers and fabulous wives and fabulous employees and look good all the time, we're all feeling guilty at some profound level because, of course, nobody's doing everything. And so when one of these articles comes out, as they do quite regularly, sort of characterizing one set of decisions that women have made, there's attacks that go on because everyone is, I think, really questioning their own choices.
Is one of the problems that spouses tend to be equals in high-powered professions? Bankers marry bankers, lawyers, doctors marry doctors. Realistically, both parents can't work a 60-hour week and travel all the time.
Yeah, and I think we tend to get so caught up in the abstractions here that we forget the underlying math. And the math is just, you know, if you have two people each working a 60 or 70-hour, even a 50-hour week, there's not enough hours in the week to take care of children. And so if you do have two people in high-powered careers and they want to have children, something's going to have to give.
Sheryl Sandberg gave the commencement address at Barnard a couple of years ago, and her point of view was that women don't make a single decision to leave the workplace. They make many small decisions along the way in their careers.
Yeah, and I think she's exactly right in that regard. I see this all the time as well, that women start pulling back in their careers. They make these small decisions and they set themselves on different tracks. And I think both Sheryl and I would agree on this, that I think it's totally fine if women want to pull back and have slower paced careers during the time they're raising children. But I would wish they'd make that decision consciously rather than feeling sort of captured by it.
Of course, this is really only a problem for women who are high wage earners.
Right, right. And I think, you know, there's two different sets of folks here. There's most women in this country work not because they're indulging their passion or their ambition. They're working because they have to. And these are the women who really are juggling like mad. But I think it is important to realize that this juggling is something that cuts across races, places, ages. I think all women I know who are trying to have some kind of a job and have a family are juggling and tired and feeling guilty.
Well, they're making this decision when they want to begin their families, not when they're trying to establish a career.
Right, right. And if you look at just the data, before women have children, they really are at a par, professionally speaking, with their male colleagues. It's once the kids come along that we start to see the much bigger divergence.
Do you think that some women take a less interesting specialty because they think they may have to eventually back out?
I think some women do that. One of the things I'm arguing in the book is that I think women should seize control of this decision and perhaps choose specialties that might not be less interesting, but if you look at medicine, where women have been quite successful, it's easier to be a mom and be an anesthesiologist than to be a surgeon because the hours are predictable.
And women doctors are less likely to leave their professions than lawyers.
Yeah, absolutely.
You have a chapter on Barbie. What's...
Yeah, so Barbie is just this astonishing phenomenon because the thing won't die. I mean, Barbie's been around as long as I have, and she's the best-selling toy of all time. She's, of course, totally unrealistic in terms of her actual proportions, and yet girls just gravitate to this doll, and they have for generations now.
Even the daughters of feminists beg for their Barbies.
That's exactly right.
Is it because it satisfies a certain stereotype in our culture?
I don't know. There's something about her beauty, as unreal as it is, that just seems to appeal to little girls in a very powerful way.
You tell a hilarious story about your friend's dollhouse and the dollhouse that your parents bought for you.
Yes. Yeah, this was one of these sort of bizarre childhood memories that my friend had this beautiful sort of over-the-top Victorian dollhouse with, you know, very sort of... luxurious furnishing, and my parents, who were really, really trying to do the right thing, got me one of these dollhouses where you constructed it yourself and you made your furniture and you sewed the clothes, which I'm sure is what I should have been doing, but I just hated the thing.
You adopted a child from Russia who immediately asked you for a Barbie in Russian?
She asked for Barbie in Russian, yes.
Deborah L. Spar, her latest book is Wonder Women, Sex, Power, and the Quest for Perfection. It's published by the Sarah Crichton imprint at Farrar, Straus & Giroux. I'm Leonard Lopate. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. Well, I've had many parents tell me that they just thought it was in the genes, that their daughter immediately gravitated toward the tutus and the pink. And then they were concerned when their daughter wanted very different kinds of clothing.
Yeah, and it's, you know, if you look back over history, parenting goes through different fads and phases. And, you know, I grew up in the time when people were really trying to get more gender-neutral toys and get girls to play with trucks and boys to play with dolls. You know, I think many kids are hardwired or they're subjected to media at such an early age that, you know, the girls do gravitate towards the pink and the tutu and the sparkles. And, you know, I come down on, you know, maybe realism, maybe giving up. But, you know, I think it's okay. You know, if your kid wants to play with a Barbie, let her.
Because,
but let her grow up.
Because
grow
people have tried to ban gender-based toys for boys and girls,
right.
And it's not working.
I don't know this statistically, but looking at my friends, it's a losing battle.
Well, if you don't give the boy a little gun, he'll just make a gun out of his
right.
hand.
That's right.
Do you think that the looks that little girls prize and emulate are all about sex? Because we are hearing that kids are being sexualized younger and younger.
Yeah, I think this is a real issue. And, you know, going back to Barbie for a second, Barbie originally was a porn doll. She was a German pornographic doll that her American creators copied.
Mattel.
Yeah, Mattel. I mean, literally, she was meant for older men. And if you look at some of the figurines that are out today, they're becoming increasingly sexualized. And I do think it's very damaging. If you watch little girls, you know, they look like porn stars. And it's, you know, that's a real problem. Pink and tutus and glitter, that's fine. But the highly sexualized images, I think, are much more problematic.
Well, it's interesting that we think of Barbie as being before the women's movement. And yet conservatives say that the sexual revolution, which was coincided in many people's lives with the women's movement has unleashed a lot of bad freedoms.
Yeah, I mean, I would disagree with that. I think, you know, net-net, as we would say, that the sexual revolution has been fabulous for women. It, you know, it has given them opportunities that would have been impossible before, particularly in the reproductive realm, where it's given women the ability to align their reproductive choices with other life choices. But we are now living in a very hypersexualized world, a world where the internet makes those images just all pervasive. And I don't, you know, I don't think we can ban them. I don't think we should ban them. But I think we need to be careful with our kids so that while they're seeing these hypersexualized images, they're also getting exposure to other images, to literature, to movies, to good conversation. And then they will move away from the Barbies or the bad images on their own.
Well, they also have a lot of the stars all are out there wearing brassieres and very little clothing, and all the children of Madonna, all the singers have come along since, have sexualized pop music. Pop music for tweens.
Right. And, you know, the pop scene is really interesting in this context, because if you go back and you look at the female pop stars of the 1960s, you know, they were Janis Joplin. They were women who wrote songs and could sing, and their looks were not what was important. Now female pop stars look like models. They kind of have to look like models. And I think that's unfortunate. It would be great if we saw, you know, a great female singer emerging who didn't also look like a model. But once again, I think it's, you know, it's crucial that we let our, you know, we can't ban our girls from watching this stuff, but we give them other role models at the same time.
A listener in Brooklyn left this comment on our show page. She writes, "I am the same age as your guest and also an academic. I never, ever felt discriminated against in the academic world and, in fact, felt that I had some advantage as a young, ambitious woman. And then I hit middle age and everything changed. By 45, accomplished and at my most confident, for the first time in my professional life, I encountered the worst kind of discrimination, hostility, et cetera, coming from men who were my age or older. It was absolutely shocking to me, and I had to rediscover feminism. I wonder if your guest, you, could speak to the problems of the middle-aged woman who becomes the inevitable dragon lady while her aging male colleagues benefit from aging, never disrespected when they confidently assert their opinions."
Yeah, it's a great point. And I have a chapter in the book on aging, which was actually fascinating for me to research and write, because I do feel that age falls more heavily on women than it does on men, I think particularly in middle age, because, you know, one of the unfortunate results of the world we're living in right now is that looks for women are still hugely important. Feminism was supposed to get rid of that. That didn't happen. So as women inevitably start to lose their looks, they also lose a big piece of their power. And if you look at movie stars, network television anchors, men are allowed to age gracefully or not, and women are not. And that's a real problem.
What about the cost of grooming for women versus men in time and money?
Yeah, this is another little thing I do in the book. I just added up the amount of time it takes me in the course of an average week, just not, you know, not to look gorgeous, but just sort of to show up at the office. And, you know, it's a lot more than the number of hours that my husband spends, particularly in New York City, I think, where there's a certain you know, sort of level of attractiveness that kind of pervades. And, you know, it's not a huge deal, but if you add it up, the average professional woman is spending somewhere between 5 to 7 additional years over the course of her career just trying to show up in the office. And I think that's worth noting, even if we can't necessarily do anything about it.
You quote from Tina Fey about middle-aged female comedians, and that, you say, speaks to the problem of middle-aged women in almost any profession.
Yeah, and Tina Fey, as always, is just, you know, brilliant writer and comedian. But she talks to the fact that women in comedy really seem to become invisible once they're no longer attractive. And for sure, that's not true for male comedians.
So looks are important. And you describe your struggle with anorexia because you felt that you weren't looking good?
I mean, I was 14 when I first became anorexic. So it's very, very hard for me now, all these years later, to really understand why I did it. I'm not sure that anyone really knows why they become anorexic. It's sort of a horribly bizarre thing to fall into.
But it is tied to a sense of perfectionism,
isn't it? It's tied deeply to a sense of perfection. And I also think it's deeply tied to a sense of control. And this is one of the things that really struck me as I was doing the research for this book, that I think anorexia gives young girls and women something that they can absolutely control, which is their own weight. Because let's be honest, if you try hard enough, you can control your weight. And to some extent, it's, I think, a manifest helplessness that I can't control my destiny, I can't control the world around me, but I can control what I eat. And it's very sad if you think about it that way.
Is one of the significant difficulties of women in the workplace that so many of them have a need to be liked?
Yes. I think this is a very real problem. I don't know exactly what we do about it. But I think many women, and I know this is true for myself, we kind of grow up liking people liking us. You know, we want to be popular. We don't want people to be angry at us. And that's fine for a certain point in your life. But as you run higher and higher in any organization, and certainly if you're running an organization, by definition, you're going to have to make decisions that will make people angry.
Well, how has that worked in the move from Harvard Business School to Barnard?
It's been hard. You know, as I've moved into a leadership position and I have to make decisions that make faculty angry or students angry or donors angry, it's a real problem for me.
What about the way you dress?
Well, the way I dress is all of a sudden much more subject of attention than it was at Harvard Business School, but not in a bad way. It's, you know, it's sort of a fun part of the job. And you know, I think women can kind of embrace that without feeling, again, guilty about it.
But you don't have to dress in the same way, do you? Did you have to dress more businesslike when you were at Harvard?
When I was at Harvard, there actually was a dress code. It varied depending on the season. So it's nice to be out of that environment. But let's be honest, there's always a dress code. Stockings, a suit, certain colors, and then you could change over the summer.
And then, well, wearing that outfit, you could run for president.
That's right. I have lots of pantsuits.
Deborah L. Spar's latest book is Wonder Women, Sex, Power, and the Quest for Perfection. It's published by the Sarah Crichton imprint at Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Do you imagine yourself staying at Barnard for a long time?
Well, it's a great place to be, and I'll stay there as long as I feel like I can make a difference and help the college get even better.
Thank you so much for being on our show again.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.